Group meeting, Saturday, 5th April, 1986. Last time, we stopped at this point, that in order to investigate, the mind must be free, and the mind must inquire freely. The searching must be unhampered by any predetermination. This is one of the great difficulties we experience whenever we try to discover something along certain lines, whatever the lines may be. That we already have some preconceptions about it. It is true that those preconceptions may be accurate, or they may not be accurate. But whether they are accurate or not accurate, the fact of having preconceptions acts like a veil or a cloud as far as observing the experience or thing afresh. To have a mind which is absolutely open means that it is a mind in the right state for learning. You know how we look at a person and say, oh, that's Joe Bloggs or something like that, you see. And if you listen to the tone of that voice, you will see, oh, that's Joe Bloggs. I know all about him already, which is quite the wrong attitude, because the universe, including each and every single one of us, is perpetually changing, constantly changing. And that change, which is something which may convey something new to us, which will produce a better relationship between him and us, is going to suffer, you see. So the mind must be unhampered by any predetermination. So, if we approach our theme as a whole, we may see the varied unfoldings of the religiousness of mankind. The word of the different scriptures presents wide disagreements and also intimate harmonies. These, of course, are due to the particular times in which the teacher flourished, the culture of the people, and so on. All these throw light on each other, the differences between the statements in the different religions. And if only our eyes have been well washed by the tears of our hearts longing for truth, we shall see its wonderful richness displayed in the variety of its expressions. And we may understand any and every religion all the better for it, if we are open-minded. Intellect is arrogant and immodest. When critical, it rends and ravishes. Wisdom is meek and chaste. When understanding, it heals and unifies. The open-minded inquiry is a wise inquiry, reverent and grateful. Grateful because we are always receiving something rich and worthwhile. Because of the openness of our mind, that which we are receiving in itself may not always be considered worthwhile and so forth. But if we are open-minded, we will find a richness in anything and everything. It challenges all authority but not with the insolent self-assertiveness of the ignorant. The first noble truth of Buddhism, for example, states that birth is sorrowful, old age or decay, and death is sorrowful. This statement is taken at face value. So too is the belief in reincarnation by the faithful of the Buddhist and Hindu world. Millions of Christians accept literally the teachings of the Immaculate Conception and Virgin Birth and the Resurrection and Ascension of Jesus. Are such beliefs true? If there is truth hidden in them, what is that truth? Is it what has been popularly believed through the centuries? You take, for instance, the belief in the virgin birth. Parthenogenesis was not known in those days. And parthenogenesis occurs in a particular kind of virus. It's rather interesting. But the virgin birth has a profound meaning and significance. Virginity is associated with the absence of concupiscence. As and when, because of the purified psyche of the individual, his insight reveals some transcendent reality to him, then there is a virgin birth. Something utterly new has been created for that person who has that insight. You see, creation and procreation are quite different. We, as human beings, biologically understand procreation. And we attribute creativeness and creation to great scientists and philosophers and artists and so forth. No, that is not creation. In the strict sense, that is procreation, cultural procreation. Procreation means that which is brought into being, that which is given birth to, is true to type. Mosquitoes will create mosquitoes, not elephants. Human beings will only create human beings. Donkeys will create donkeys, and silly asses will create silly asses, in whichever species you look. It's like that. That is procreation, true to type. But when there is true creation, it is something utterly new, something which was never before in manifestation. And in one's own personal life, when that sort of rich insight emerges, that is a true creation because it is completely new for you yourself. Again, it is not rare to come across such statements as dangerously near to pantheism, or oriental fatalism, negativity, nihilism, but this is Gnosticism. Statements like that you hear, Gnostic heresy, etc. What value is there in such statements, in addition to telling us something about the mind and character of those who make them? The people who make such statements reveal just just what is the condition of their mind, what stage of development their mind is. One more example will suffice. The founders of some great religions are presented as perfect and holy men who triumphed over temptation and lived sinless lives, and who had supernatural powers and performed miracles. In short, they are presented as stylized pictures of perfection and, in at least two cases, as embodiments of deity. The two cases are Jesus and Krishna. Sri Krishna is regarded by the Hindus as the deity, actually the deity embodied. Is this true? Just what does such a picture signify? How does it arise? And what value has it? Our concern is truth, the heart of religion. And remember that truth for each individual is of an individual, unique nature, because each individual is unique, is utterly different from anyone that ever was, is, or will be. You know why that is? You see, in the process of procreation, the male and the female each produce a gamete, a reproductive cell, which is quite different from a non-reproductive cell. The bulk of the cells in our bodies are non-reproductive. But the gamete is a reproductive cell. That gamete is derived from the parents of the male and the parents of the female by a reorientation of all the genetic factors. They are since there are so many millions of them, the number of permutations and combinations is just infinite. And so that's what takes place when the zygote, the fetus, is formed. And that is why each person is utterly different. No one ever was like him or her, is like him or her, or will be like him or her. And that fact influences the manner, the mode in which that particular individual becomes aware of the truth. The awareness in its depth is different from everybody else's awareness. The verbal formulation may be similar. In fact, it is often quite similar. If, for instance, you read Saint Teresa's writings, you will find her use phrases which are identical phrases with those used by in yoga. You'll find it in the Yoga Upanishads and by the Buddha. They're identical phrases. Now, of course, it is questionable whether Saint Teresa ever came across the writings of the East. It is not probable. It is possible, of course, but it is not probable. Now, and you take for instance, again, Meister Eckhart. He says in one of his sermons, which is called Hindrances. These were sermons which are known as the Ascension Day sermons. In one of them, he makes this statement: man truly is God, God truly is man. How on earth he wasn't burnt at the stake straight away is a mystery. But there you are. That statement is on page 194 of the first volume of the translations. And there are statements like that which are the exact sort of statements which were made in the Upanishads. Aham Brahmasmi, I am the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. Now, what our concern is truth. So the open-minded inquiry must be serious and fearless. If the mind is truly open, it will also be without fear. Fear is one of the elements which is responsible for our biases and prejudices, our preconceptions and assumptions. We take them for granted, we take them as truth, because we are afraid that something harmful would happen to us if we did not. Religion is not the exclusive preserve of the established great religions of the world, still less of the organized churches claiming authority to lay down what is or is not religious truth. This is especially true of the heart of religion. Whatever, this is my own feeling about religion. Whatever purifies and perfects a man, relates him fully to life, and allows the realization of the transcendent is religion. Consider the meaning of the word religion. I think I've mentioned this a few times in previous meetings. The word religio, Cicero said derived it from re legere, meaning to gather together. Servius, he lived between 146 and 43 BC. After the birth of Christ, after the birth and death of Christ, Servius Lactantius, who lived in the 3rd century, and St. Augustine, I'm not certain whether it was St. Augustine of Hippo or the St. Augustine who came to England and was responsible for introducing Christianity into England and establishing it. These three, Servius Lactantius and St. Augustine, derived the word religion from re ligare, not re legere. Re legere, together, together. Re ligare, the root of re ligare is lig, meaning to bind. And re ligare means to bind back, and of course in the religious context, to the origin, that means to God, from who created everything. You see? So that is how they defined the word religion. I like to look at it this way. Whatever purifies and perfects a man, relates him fully to life, and allows the realization of the transcendent, is religion. Whoso can retell the holiness of the old scriptural word in terms of realization effectively serves his age and milieu. Such is the saint, the poet seer, the yogi, the mystic. If he is one who spontaneously lives the truth, If he is the embodiment of wisdom and the heart of love, if he is one who utters the new word and makes the new affirmation, then a new world teacher is in our midst. It is necessary for our inquiry to be sensitive to that fact, to be watchful and be able to see if indeed in our own day any enlightened being walks the earth. How often we hear a person say, "Oh, if I had been living in the time of Jesus or the time of the Buddha or something, the marvelous things that he would be doing." Utter nonsense. The overwhelming likelihood is that he would be blind. He wouldn't be able to see that here is the enlightened one. Here is a son of God, a Brahmaputra. He would be unable. More, it is imperatively necessary to understand his teaching, for this teaching, which will bear the stamp of originality, will be wholly relevant for today's human situation. Mere preoccupation with the glorious past is nostalgia for the dead. The true glory is no other than the actual light of the living present. If this is missed, harping on the glorious past is the hallmark of our own dullness. And I'm afraid this applies particularly strongly to India. They're always talking about their wonderful, glorious past and all the great, thank you, will you? All the great teachers and so on. And that dead past will be a burden which crushes our spirit. In fact, however fondly we may delude ourselves that it refreshes us. We'll wait a moment till he comes. To make the significance of the great teachings of the past concerning the heart of religion come alive in modern terms is not, therefore, the whole of our task. Every epoch has its own limitations. Whilst eternal verity is eternal verity, its expression always suffers the constraints of the age in which it is affirmed. When the world situation ushers in a new age, the old constraints, the old opportunities, and even the old significances change. This is pointedly true today as perhaps never before, which makes it so necessary to see the new emergence which is significant now, and to see its intimate relationship with modern life. This new emergence will, in course of time, radically alter the whole ambit of the long-established great religions. This ambit is so vast that we must deal in our inquiry mainly with those elements which constitute or bear upon the heart of religion. See, the world situation always... the world situation always changes the way in which we can sense or have an insight into truth. Simply because throughout the centuries, there is a growth in science, mathematics, philosophy, and so on. See, these things give us a profounder knowledge of the nature of things. And the knowledge of the nature of things, of the manifested world, our own environment, our surroundings, and the universe as a whole, profounder knowledge of the nature of things has an influence on our ability to be sensitive to receiving that flash of insight which we call truth. People little realize what an immense effect the development of science and mathematics and the knowledge of things has had upon man's presentation of the deep, the so-called eternal verities. It has had an extraordinary influence. That is why ordinary academic study can be quite helpful. Very helpful, in fact. And in our present age, science will prove, already has proved, but perhaps the most powerful factor in changing our outlook and our capacity to see the reality as reality. I'll give you just one outstanding example. At the beginning of this century, scientists began to penetrate into what we call the subatomic world. And throughout this century, we have discovered again and again that what we call the laws of nature of the which hold good in the ordinary atomic world, our world, our macroscopic world, the world on the large scale, do not apply to that subatomic world. The outstanding example is the doctrine of causality. You know how the Buddha, for example, laid the greatest possible emphasis upon causality. Everything happens as the inevitable result, the effect of the preceding cause, or the set of causes. That does not hold in the subatomic sphere. We know that for a certainty. And also we have discovered that what we call energy, pure energy, which is immaterial, and mass, which is material, are interchangeable. This knowledge of the interchangeability of mass and energy, at least for me, completely does away with the difference between the spiritual world and the material world, between spirit and matter, God and man, and all the rest of the stuff. You see? That is why I chose, when I started talking about these things and writing about them, I chose to use the term the one total reality. We don't know what the one total reality is. But whatsoever there is, and which we will discover as time goes on, is part and parcel, an integral part and parcel of that one total reality. You see? Therefore, to talk in terms of, oh, the spirit is superb and supreme and all the rest of it, and matter is evil, and is absolute nonsense. It is just one thing, one unitary whole. And if that statement becomes a conscious realization in anybody, then for that period in time, and under those world conditions, that person has given out the supreme truth and expresses the supreme truth. But you have to become conscious of it. Do realize that merely holding an idea, holding a mere belief in something is of little value. A belief is usually impotent, certainly as far as good and truth are concerned. A belief is very potent for doing harm to mankind if it is only in political and social terms. Workers of the world, unite. You have only your chains to lose. What has happened? Look at the belief of the people in the Middle Ages and so on, which led, which made the inquisitors burn people alive in order to save their souls. Those inquisitors and modern people too who talk about souls don't know what they are talking about. On the one hand, they will say the soul is immortal. All right. If the soul is immortal, it is infinite and eternal, because that is the context of immortality. It is the context of transcendence. It is the context of God or whatever you hold as transcendent. Now, can you slice that up? Can you split that up and apportion? Oh, this soul for you, this soul for you, this soul for you. It's utterly ridiculous nonsense. Not one of us can talk about my soul. If by soul or spirit you mean this energy which is universal, which is total, which functions in terms of infinity and eternity, then you can't possess a bit of it, a small portion which is your soul. I shall be interested to see any criticisms in my book on Zarathustra, where I have brought this out. I have brought this out very clearly. So you see, we have to keep our minds open. As we develop and grow through the purification of body and psyche, the psychophysical organism is the vehicle through which consciousness becomes enlightened. What is it that becomes enlightened? Not my nose or my toenail. It's my consciousness which becomes enlightened. And when it becomes enlightened, as and when it becomes enlightened, it would be incorrect for me to use the term my consciousness, because it becomes the universal consciousness. All the perfected holy ones, the great teachers, their consciousness was a universal consciousness. You know how it is said of all of them, Christ, Buddha and so on, that when they met somebody, they knew that somebody. They knew him inside out. When Jesus met the woman who had five husbands and whatnot and so forth, like a modern film star, you see. How did he know? Because when your consciousness has completely freed itself from the limitations of isolative, separative self-consciousness, confined and limited to yourself, then you are able to be conscious in terms of the totality, as and when you want. That is how they know them. It is said of the Buddha, for instance, that when he woke up in the morning, he looked over the whole world with the eye of a Buddha and saw who and was in suffering, what was, and accordingly sent help. Spiritual, you see. Now, how could that happen, apart from the fact that he has this universal consciousness? Therefore, he knows. He can know if he wants to. He does not usually use that faculty, because the one who has developed these very great psychic powers does not pry into your own privacy. They won't do it. It's one of the rules of the esoteric schools, that you must respect the privacy of any particular individual. If it is becomes necessary that you should look into it because he wants you to look at it, look into it or something, then you can. See, it's like that. So, all this from science and its influence upon our sensitivity to the truth. We've finished 3 chapters now, after 1 year and 3 months. Now, the chapter 4 is entitled The Injunction and the Mandate. Now, as regards searching for the truth, at first sight, the gates are barred. Sri Rama says to Hanuman, never should the Upanishads be imparted to an atheist, an ungrateful person, one intent on vicious actions, one having no devotion to me, or one who loses his way in the cave of books. What a wonderful statement. I remember, it was about 45 years ago, I think, when I read that in the volume of the so-called Minor Upanishads, something struck me very hard inwardly, because I have always suffered from intellectual greed. I wanted to know all about everything. And therefore, I also suffered from terrible conceit. I knew. You know that lovely story about Mark Twain. It was Mark Twain, I think, who writing about his father, talking about his father, when Mark Twain was very young, in his early teens, he said that the old boy didn't know very much. And when he came to the end, by the time Mark Twain came to the end of his teens, he said, it's astonishing how much the old boy did know. On no account should they be given to one devoid of devotion. You have to be devoted to the truth. Devotion is an extraordinary sort of virtue, quality. It is a love which gives one's total self to that which is loved. You are devoted. This quotation comes from the Muktika Upanishad. The sage Svetashvatara says, this highest mystery in the Vedanta, which has been declared in a former age, should not be given to one whose passions are not subdued, nor again to one who is not a son or a pupil. Don't be misled by the word son. It is true that several of them had wives and they had children also. But the special meaning of the word son in the religious context as it occurs in the scriptures is, I am sure, precisely this. A holy one had several disciples. The disciple who was most advanced and nearest to the teacher himself was called the son of the teacher. You remember in the second book of Kings, that marvelous account of Elijah, of Elisha and Elijah walking together out of Gilgal unto Bethel, unto Jericho, and finally unto Jordan. And at Jericho, Elijah, and the name means God Himself, Eliyah, Eli is God, Eliyah, God Himself, he asks Elisha, ask what boon you will, before we go any further. And Elisha says, let a double portion of thy blessing be upon me. And Elijah says, thou hast asked a very hard thing. You know the meaning of that statement. In the Jewish system, the eldest son received twice as much as each of the other sons. That was the custom. And to receive the eldest, to receive the double portion meant that Elisha was to be regarded and recognized as the son of Elijah. Now Elisha, the name, means God the Savior. You see, this is a story which really is a wonderful esoteric story of the inner process which goes on within the individual himself, Elisha and Elijah. But Elijah says then, but if you see me when I am taken up in the, you know, in the chariot of fire with the horsemen, the four horsemen, not the four horsemen. If you see me, then my mantle will fall upon you. So son really means just that, the most advanced disciple of the teacher. At each of the points, Gilgal, Bethel, Jericho, there are always 50 sons of the prophets who are waiting to see these two pass by. Believe me, the prophets did not, none of those prophets had 50 sons. You know, Homer says, gives King Priam of Troy 100 sons and so forth. These are just ways of talking, suggesting something very, very deep, which you must find out for yourself. So, if a person is not a son, not reached that stage, then don't reveal the highest mystery of the Vedanta. What was the highest mystery of the Vedanta? I can put it in, suggest it in these terms today. It was the realization of holistic consciousness. That consciousness which has become one with the total reality, which is utterly free of all isolativeness and separativeness. And then what has happened is that transcendence has realized its transcendence in fullest measure as a human being. And I have explained this before several times. Human means blissful creator.